So 5 minutes, somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes, if you want to respond to those comments, more towards 3, and then we'll open it up and we'll have some questions here.
Well, except for the first one, what's up with the EU incentives? Are they getting a bit lesser these days, especially now that the economic crisis hit in and there are tendencies to go to the right?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole European Union has kind of shifted a bit to the right. We can see it, as you mentioned, in Hungary. Mm-hmm. We can see it in Austria. We can see it in other countries. I believe we can see it now also in the countries that are trying to join the EU. For instance, in Serbia, my own country, we have now elected a more of a nationalist government, where former Milosevic's party, SPS, is in the government, and there's also SNS, so that's like a party that's split up from Vojislav Šešelj. So, but still, even in those conditions, there is this EU spark. And even though the support for the EU is dropping, I don't think it's going to go away that fast. And even those who are totally nationalist and right-wing and are flirting with Russia are still kind of trying to get it on with the EU. So that's what I think. There's still something going on.
Well, there's no more to promise. There's still the hope.
There's still the hope. And for the second one, so the proposals when it comes to those improvements, what I meant was actually, I was looking into the human rights laws and legislations that were adopted in those countries that are joining the EU, and it's basically the same thing. So you got the anti-discrimination law. Everybody's adopted anti-discrimination law. They get the free visa-free regime. Get the ombudsperson office. They develop the ombudsperson office. You get the institution of freedom of information, commissioner for freedom of information, to get down with the corruption. But the problem is that those changes, they're trying to achieve those changes by adopting laws. And those laws, when copied in systems that are corrupt and governments, they're not willing to comply completely, but maybe want to comply minimally, they don't work. So there's lack of this effectiveness of measures that the EU puts when it comes to human rights conditions. And this is what I mean with policies and other sort of means. It means getting outside the law and seeing maybe educational policies, other policies, other sort of means to get through to the wider circle of population, not just laws in institutions that don't function. For instance, you can make a policy to put in human rights education in schools, and you can do that with certain actors in the domestic countries, NGOs, maybe something like twinning or something like that. So go on that sort of a level and make it into education policy and try to make impact in that matter, not just by putting a law and then you have like politicians saying, okay, well, we've adopted those laws, everything's okay. Minorities' rights. We have formed National Minorities Council, so everything's okay with our minorities now, right? No, it isn't.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oliver, thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate them. As you know, in my dissertation, I pay a lot more attention to the European kind of approach to working time regulation and explain that there's a reason why the standards are set the way they are. They're just minimum standards because the EU doesn't actually have the competences to set anything else than minimum standards in relation to working time. And I also explore how sort of over time the expansion in competences and kind of developments in different forms of regulation kind of yielded this working time regime at the European level that is bifurcated because it addresses certain forms of working time regulation in ways that very explicitly acknowledge their impact on equality and work-family reconciliation, and then some that don't. And this particular directive, which I talk about in my paper, is one of the early first working time regulation that doesn't really get into gender, and it is minimum. It does set minimum standards, And indeed, when the directive was adopted, it was greeted as a victory at the by European labor, because it was really important to have this kind of a standard at the EU level, even though there were huge holes in it. Having it to begin with was important. So certainly, it's not it's not all EU fault. Indeed, I think in my when I really think back to my dissertation now, I think it's mostly the Polish context, really. The manner in which this directive was transposed, kind of progressively deregulating Polish labor code, it really had to do very much with Polish politics, with kind of the neoliberal tendency that's been prevalent in Poland since the late 80s, even before the transition began. And also with kind of the peculiarities of the Polish labor relations. Polish unions were, you know, unlike unions in most European countries, they actually actively partook in the neoliberal transition. They supported it and later kind of channeled all their resources into their political wing rather than their labor wing. So in the process, they lost popular support. And they're so weak in a sense now that that employer organizations and business lobby were able to kind of be better at lobbying the government. So it really, I think the story is of both, of this interesting relationship. It is a story about local, I think, domestic politics and context, but Polish kind of ongoing transition occurs in a context which now And legal reform occurs in a context that has this other kind of level or scale, the European scale, and it's against this backdrop that the decisions about legal reform I made. So I think in that sense, the European working time regime is really crucial, because it's provided excuses to deregulate, but it also, on a positive note, it also has inspired some kind of more positive developments as well. I'm not sure if this answers your question.
But if you were, let's say, someone in a social movement, unionist, right, mm-hmm. with a gender interest, you know, where would you say, you know, you should lobby, right? You know, would it be Poland, or would you put your hope into the EU becoming one of the major players in helping to set the agenda for more equal, you know, more gender-sensitive, you know, regulation of working time?
Yeah, I would lobby at the EU level, most certainly, because especially, maybe the current Polish government is one that's more receptive, partially because it wants to be seen as so European. But I think most Polish NGOs have learned that they need to lobby at the European level. They also need to they've been quite good at developing relationships with NGOs in other, like Germany, other European countries. So I think the EU level is there, because there's definitely a big, the gender policy is quite prominent, even though there's criticism around it being kind of instrumentalist, but the EU level is the place, I think, to lobby.
So, any questions from the audience?
I have a suggestion for Alexandra. I thought something that may be really interesting and pertinent for your work is to maybe have a conversation on monitoring with human rights. That may be another work to come from now, but I think that that may be really pertinent to what you're talking about. And I think that shows some interesting causal stuff going on. So maybe just for a thought, at least.
Yeah, kind of jumping on that. One thing I'm kind of curious is if you've explored this as to whether, even though I think EU conditionality, a lot of people have argued that it's very, very effective, particularly in the short run, because it's a very power asymmetric balance between the EU and the acceding member state, it is nonetheless a very temporary measure. And I have a colleague who's done some work on civil society organizations in Bulgaria, and there's been considerable evidence that when the accession process happened, a lot of these non-EU bodies, specifically USAID, pretty much abandoned their work in Bulgaria, because all this was kind of handed over to the EU. And I'm wondering if you might find that in the area of human rights, maybe in the long run, kind of a disservice is done in terms of monitoring, because while they do a very good job temporarily, they might kind of expunge these more permanent organizations that don't rest on this given kind of set timeline.
If you came up with this hypothesis, you would get a guaranteed publication. That's a provocative hypothesis. But.
I believe that that's why I'm actually looking at different sort of means to go about changing societies, not just laws. And I've been looking at more into when it comes to my thesis research, which is discrimination based on sexual orientation in those countries. So that's been a bit difficult to make changes in that sort of area, and the laws were proven to be really, really ineffective. And I believe that there should be something more substantial to affect the culture and the people and the education, especially education, in order to make those changes more permanent. This way, I don't think it's going to function in the long run. For instance, if you have an ombudsperson institution that's supposed to protect violations of human rights that were committed by state officials or government representatives, and that institution has its office for 2 years, and then afterwards there's problems with the budgetings, and then afterwards it has problems with powers, you're not actually making that kind of effective. You have ombudsperson institutions, that's good, that's good points. You have anti-discrimination laws, that's good points. But when you look at what those laws and changes and institutions are doing to make the change happen, it's pretty weak at this point. Whether it will continue to be weak in the long run, I believe it will be really difficult to make some further long-run changes and wider changes if those institutions continue to function like they do. I think there needs to be something else, something different that needs to be done when it comes to human rights in order to make it more permanent.
I think your focus on minority rights is a very good one, that what else suggested, mm-hmm. but you have to look also at the counterintuitive effects of EU enlargement, right? Yeah, that maybe, you know, in this process, yeah, there was more recognition, but you know, once members sit here, you could even look at, you know, maybe that some of those provisions and initiatives, right, there have been, you know, stalled or, you know, even reversed. So that will be great to see. So, yeah, if you have this comparison between non-EU member state, right, yeah, those all being and an EU member state, right, that would be great. Yeah.
And I think particularly, I think the EU has not necessarily been so effective at ensuring that conditionality is maintained in areas like human rights. I think in areas like economic matters, and particularly macroeconomic governance, it's been a hawk. And it's been particularly able to do this is because these countries also have to meet EMU criteria. Now with the crisis, there's a lot of expectation that they have to keep their fiscal houses in order. But, I mean, you just look at Hungary. When Hungary committed all these violations, the first thing the EU clamped down on was central bank independence rather than the press or rather than human rights violations. So, you know, taking away those grassroots organizations that, you know, might not have been effective, maybe they were, you know, I wonder if there's kind of a perverse feedback effect, so to speak, with the EU coming in.
I did actually want to pose a question to Anya. I'm not in a great position to really start picking through the technicalities and the minutiae of your piece, because I think certain portions of it are beyond me. But I think my question really has more to do with attempting to place your argument into context a little bit better. I mean, when I'm attempting to process your argument and its broader implications, I usually have in the back of my mind a more developed Western European country. So when I'm thinking about making the labor market less friendly to, you know, not a substantial portion of the population, I'm usually thinking about it in the context of, relatively low labor market, labor force participation. It's a cause for, shaking your head on those practical grounds alongside the normative ones. But I have to admit, I don't know anywhere near as much about the Polish context. So I'm curious about that, how that compares and how your argument about the labor market becoming less family friendly fits with demographic trends there and with overall labor force participation.
Well, as a sort of Polish, as I mentioned in my presentation, the process of transition lowered labor force participation among both men and women because the unemployment rates were so high for so long, and even now that they've recovered and are actually quite low, I think just under 10% definitely, the participation rates are still lower than they had been before transition and lower than they are in many other EU member states. And the demographic rates are as bad, sort of, or the fertility rates are as low as they are in Germany. Poland has one of the lowest fertility rates in Europe. I think the second lowest. In that sense, it's very important to make the labor market more family friendly, to encourage, and sort of that's kind of the policy, a big policy at the European level, to activate women, to make the labor market family friendly, workplaces family friendly. So much emphasis on positive forms of flexibility revolves around these two issues. So yeah, these are definitely Polish problems, and yet it's only now this current administration that's taking some steps to alleviate that. But before that, there was so much emphasis on eradicating unemployment, but the assumption was that people have to take sort of look after their own families. The state really pulled out, so there was no really effort to provide any form of assistance, and the assumption was that people will figure it out, whether it's because all their retired women will look after their daughters, children, or sons' children, etc. It was really that responsibility for social reproduction was really shifted to Poles, to the population. And the only efforts were only on increasing increasing employment rates. Of course, demographers and sociologists, as I mentioned, have been really active in publishing and writing policy papers showing that actually in Poland, there's a clear link between women's labor market participation and fertility. And the link is that women do not have a second child unless they have a job. And it's only now that there is this wake-up call that, in fact, the policy has to be such that tries to balance those, make it easier for people to balance those two kind of aspects of their life. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, it most certainly does. Thank you.
I have a comment, mostly engaging with Alexander's paper, and just brought to mind exactly how we gauge compliance and whether it's time sensitive. And what exactly countries need to do to comply. And you brought up these mechanisms that I've also come across, benchmarking, monitoring, and gatekeeping. Because in my research, the EU has been particularly poor at monitoring capabilities, and that's why it gets me to think about compliance. Because when I say, what do they have to do and what role does the EU have to play in this whole monitoring and deciding on whether a country is complied or not, the EU normally, in my research, has a very influential role in the development of policy, but not the implementation of policy. And I think that's where, in Croatia specifically, that's where the candidate states have had a very influential role in the key process and changing their country to kind of fit their needs and their desires. And so my question, or not my question, but more my comment is looking at exactly what compliance is. Because if you're looking about, providing some alternatives, focusing on education and so on, is the EU's role then separated from deciding on whether a country complies? Because if you're talking about education and some of these things that maybe have a longer time or a longer run, is that still part of the compliance process, and what role would the EU have in that? And what role does those alternatives that you have in the actual accession process? Because if it's going to take longer, if you think that more effective measures would be education programs instead of laws and policies, that's something that usually the EU kind of is more hands-off about.
Yeah.
And so what role do those alternatives have in the accession process, and whether the EU can really count on those measures to, for instance, help Serbia become a member? I just a comment. I know we're running out of time. Maybe we
can,
I
can just answer just briefly, and then we can talk more afterwards. What I think might be the solution in that case, because I understand, like, education policy, like, it's no, like, don't go into, like, that state's thing, state's issue. So it's, like, a really big, important thing. What I see as maybe an opportunity is to kind of tie those policies to the means that they're using right now. For instance, if they want to put a law that's anti-discrimination, let's put human rights education in that. Let's make kind of instructions to the states, more detail. Because if you say you need to do this, you need to say also you need to do this by doing this, and this. So more details, because as we've seen in the process, a lot of states do not actually want to implement those things. So they're just kind of adopting it as much as they can take. Like, they can adopt a law, make an institution, but they won't do much about anything else in ensuring that that functions. So you need to kind of make, like, a roadmap, like, tell European Union, like, tell the states, okay, in order to fix this issue of human rights, you need to adopt this legislation. This legislation has to be like this, and it has to be applied like this. And this is also another sort of like educational policy that comes along with it, which is beneficial to ensuring that this problem is resolved. So maybe something like that could be an option. But I'm glad to discuss that further with you. It's just something I've been thinking about.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. Panel, Dr. Schmidt-Kay. The schedule now is we have afternoon snack with sandwiches and a bit bigger than what we had just maybe an hour and a half ago or something. So if we want to transition to the next room, the next panel should start around 3:30. We're just waiting on Dr. Schmidt-Kay.